This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The PhD degree lies in ruins. That is the first sentence of a preview written about a book called The New PhD, How to Build a Better Graduate Education. The authors feel the PhD needs to quickly evolve to serve the needs of students and society. And here to talk about the book are those two authors. Robert Weisbuch is a former professor of English at the University of Michigan, served as president of the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation, and was the 11th president of Drew University. Leonard Casuto is a professor of English and American Studies at Fordham University and a columnist for the Chronicle of Higher Education. When I spoke to them about the book earlier this year, I started by asking Professor Weisbuch why they feel we need a new PhD.
The first problem of the PhD is that it tends to train people for jobs that don't exist. The proportion of PhD graduates who don't end up as professors at a research university is astronomical, perhaps 90%. And so if programs in the PhD are only designed to replicate the faculty, they fail at an enormous rate. We don't think that's what a PhD ought to be about. We think it ought to be about creating expertise in all the different social sectors, and that students shouldn't simply be programmed into becoming mini-me's of faculty members. Rather, we're looking for a kind of student-centered, public-facing program that provides a lot of diversity and career outcomes and provides success for the students. So we're always saying, let's start with the students. What is it that they need? Whereas in many PhD programs today, they really seem to be designed more for the faculty interest.
Has it always been so? Was there a time when the PhD really did crank out prepared students?
Graduate school has always been a faculty-centered enterprise in its modern history. That is to say, if we look at teaching, for example, there's a bookshelf full of research on undergraduate teaching, but only a scant amount on graduate teaching. And that's because graduate teaching has been traditionally viewed as emanating from faculty research. We want to encourage universities and the general public to look at graduate school differently as a student-centered enterprise. But if we look at the history of graduate school in the United States, the history of graduate school is a noble history. It's a research enterprise that has had some wonderful achievements over the years. But there was one moment in the 1960s, in the post-war era, one moment when there were more jobs, more professors' jobs, than there were PhDs to fill them. That was the product of the extremely rapid expansion of the sector in the years following World War II. It was one generation, and when the jobs filled up, professors didn't realize it, and they continued to train their students as though a professor's job were the only job that they should aspire to, the only job that they should want. The biggest problem with graduate school right now is not only, as Bob says, that we're preparing students for jobs that don't exist, we're also teaching students to want those jobs above all others and to be unhappy with any other prospect.
Well, as a graduate student said to me, she said, I feel like I'm a victim of a Ponzi scheme, in the sense that, you know, she entered graduate school in order to live the life that she saw her professors living, and the chances for that were very small. I mean, a fair question you might ask us is, who cares? That is, the number of PhD graduates in any one year is tiny in comparison to the number of high school or college graduates. But the fact is that doctoral education, PhD education, is sort of the opposite of Las Vegas. You know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. What happens in the PhD doesn't stay within the PhD. This is where the discoveries are made. This is where the norms and standards for every academic discipline get set. And so what happens in the PhD affects instruction in colleges, in high schools, even in grade schools.
Is there another career that a PhD could aspire to right now other than, you know, getting a tenured professorial job and there I am, I'm set for life?
Well, the real answer to that is to change the question a little bit. What kind of career would not be appropriate for a PhD? That is, they bring all those qualities of imagination, creativity, research capacity, expertise in teaching. Can you imagine a career where teaching doesn't go on in one informal way or another? And so really the question is, what can't they do rather than what can they do?
Looking at the student body now who are going for PhDs, do they look like America? Or is it a diverse student body?
We've got a big problem there. The PhD is too white and too male. And there's a consensus in academia around that idea. That is, we don't have debates about whether diversity is appropriate in academia. It's no secret that academia is a left-leaning enterprise. And so professors and other employees of the university, administrators, we all agree that we'd like to see more diversity in graduate school. We'd like to see graduate school look more like America. The reason why we don't has a lot to do with the PhD's position at the top of a pyramid. You can only recruit for the PhD among qualified college graduates. By that time, the numbers you have of people from underrepresented groups is already too low. In order for graduate school to become more diverse, people who like us, who are in charge of bringing people into graduate school, have to do a lot of things much sooner. We have to recruit, and we have to also improve our relations with K through 12. It has been often said by us that it's hard to find a major industry that shows greater indifference to its main supplier than universities do to K through 12. If we're going to make graduate school look like America, then we have to make undergraduate school look like America. And we have to make K through 12 look like a place where people want to go to college and want to study and go on into fields that they're going to want to pursue later on.
Here's an example. Len has written about a program at Irvine called Think, where professors in the philosophy department visit a grade school four times in a month, and they lead the students in a philosophical discussion of a story or a text that they've read. Now, that's extreme, but it's exactly what we need. That is to say, if we can't interest students in the life of thought when they're 7 years old or 13 years old, if they drop out after eighth grade or after high school or don't go on for the BA, then your cohort going on for the PhD is going to be impoverished in just that way in terms of people of color, women, first-generation students. We want to change that cohort.
One more word about this, too. One of the biggest problems with graduate school right now is that there is an attrition rate that approaches 50%. It's astoundingly high. We ought not to tolerate any workplace that loses 50% of its workers before they complete their main project.
In study after study, we've learned that students of color and women are especially concerned with applying what they learn in the PhD back to their communities. And that's one of many considerations that we haven't emphasized enough in the old PhD, so that we need more and more in the new PhD to say to students, not only this is what you know, but also this is how you can apply what you know. This is what you can do with it.
So who is out there saying, don't change the PhD, it's perfect the way it is?
Faculty. Faculty are a conservative lot. In fact, university education in general is conservative with a small c. And we ought to be happy about that in the main, because we don't want academia to be blowing about in response to whatever the latest fad or trend may be. We like the fact that higher education is a stable business. And that kind of predictability is part of its appeal. It's one of the bedrock institutions that underlie the democracy. But graduate school is conservative even by the standards of academia. And it's so conservative that it becomes rigid. Graduate school today resembles very much graduate school of 125 years ago. Not enough has changed. The kind of conservatism that arises from faculty who, in particular, imagine that they are preparing students for professors' jobs when it's been over 50 years since this sector could replenish itself with its own graduates and perform that replication game. Graduate school has to wake up to the reality that we're in, and the conservatism of professors is one of the obstacles that stands in our way. Now, there is some reform that's been going on around the country, and our book details that reform. There are a lot of specific examples of programs that we cite in the book, including the one that Bob mentioned a few minutes ago at the University of California at Irvine, that are forward-looking. But as a general rule, graduate school and the faculty members who are in charge of it are not looking forward in the way that we should recognize that we need to.
We like faculty. We don't want to knock them unduly. We're all creatures
of habit. We are faculty.
And we are faculty, that's right. I think that there are probably two problems that make faculty so oppositional to change. Maybe three. One of them is just the human fact that we're habitual. We like habit. Second one, though, is that when things start in academia, it's very difficult to stop them. And so for any innovation, we need a sell-by date. We need a time, let's say 3 years after the innovation, the improvement, the supposed improvement has been agreed upon, to look at it and say, do we want to keep it? Do we want to expand it? Or should we stop it? If we could do that more often, faculty would be more willing to change. And I think the other reason that faculty have trouble seeing that they need to change not their basic ethics, but their practices, is because they really don't know much about graduate education. That may sound strange since they practice it every day, but it's very hard for people to gain a perspective on something that they're utterly immersed in. And so one of the necessities for any graduate program to change is to educate the faculty, is to get the faculty to read up on what's actually going on with students and to survey the students themselves, to hear from their own students what their lives are like. There was a chair of English at Columbia University several years ago who led such a survey. And he said, I never knew. We fund most of our students, but I didn't know that almost all of them have part-time jobs of up to 20 and 30 hours a week. Well, you should know that. And so the first thing to do to educate yourself as a faculty member is to ask your students what their lives are like, not just what their courses are like, but what their existence is as they're in graduate school. You'll be surprised by the answer.
Still to come, our conversation with Bob Weisbuck and Len Cassuto continues with a look at the problems faced by adjunct professors. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. And today we're listening again to my conversation with Robert Weisbuck and Leonard Cassuto, authors of the book The New PhD, How to Build a Better Graduate Education. One of the continuing issues they bring up in the book is the problems faced by adjunct professors.
Adjuncts are one of the biggest problems that academia has been struggling with for a long time. They have come into public view in recent years, and that can only be a benefit. It's a human tragedy that you have people with PhDs who are struggling to try to catch a foothold in this narrow, unforgiving academic economy, working for fast food wages when they could be doing social good, to say nothing of good for themselves, if they oriented themselves outward. Universities exploit adjuncts, but adjuncts allow themselves to be exploited in ways that human dignity should not permit. Adjuncts should be looking elsewhere for work that affirms and dignifies them. The economy of teaching and learning needs to be restructured in a way that ought to make adjuncting the province of the people for whom it was originally designed properly for, people who have paying jobs, for whom teaching the occasional university course is literally adjunct work.
Many adjuncts choose to continue even at these terribly low wages and difficult work hours and so on, many of them working at 4 and 5 different schools to make ends meet, so that much as they are dedicated to their students, with the best heart in the world, they can't give the student the kind of attention that they'd be able to if they were better supported. But many of them continue as adjuncts because they love the life of the university. They love being in the university. one of our points in the book is to say that even within the university, even if you don't leave the campus, every university, every college is something of a city or town. There's an office of media, there's an office of admissions, there's an office of development, fundraising, and so on. And so it would be possible to have a good career in a university without being necessarily a professor, and perhaps if you love teaching, doing a little teaching on the side. That's a dignified existence. Being an adjunct today is really an insult to our colleagues' abilities who have had to serve as adjuncts. And really, you asked at the beginning of this program, why did you decide to write this book? I should have given you a more personal answer, and I think it's one that Lenny shares. For 25 years, I worked with graduate students at the University of Michigan. They were superb. I just loved working with them. But what I hated was seeing what happened to them afterwards, as so few of them were able to achieve fulfilling professorial careers and felt themselves to be failures. They didn't fail. Our society and our universities and our programs failed them.
Are there places right now where these changes are at least starting?
Yes, there are. There are a number of universities that are sponsoring this kind of change from above. And there are any number of individual graduate programs in individual subjects at individual universities where the administrators are trying to change the worldview. One of the issues that troubles the graduate enterprise is that it's so decentralized. One of the reasons we wrote this book was to bring a lot of the examples of best practice to the attention of people who might want to change themselves but don't know where to start. For example, there's a program at the University of Louisville that combines workshops in anything from networking to writing your curriculum vitae or your resume to preparing for different kinds of job searches. And this collection of workshops is something that's sponsored by the graduate school and is available to all students, and they are aware of it and the faculty are aware of it. In other words, it's a significant cultural change, which makes a difference there. There are similar programs at the University of Virginia, at Duke University, at Emory University, that are in various stages of development. We would like for everybody to know about these so that they can build with the examples in mind. Instead of having people invest so much effort to reinvent wheels that some people have already not only invented, but put on the road.
One of the reasons it is hard to change is that typically when it comes to the PhD, nobody's in charge. It's left to individual faculty and individual programs. Some schools don't even have a graduate dean, and those who do, and I've served as a graduate dean, I can tell you this, the graduate dean tends to serve tea more often than she serves students. And so you have a graduate dean who doesn't have resources to incentivize the faculty, doesn't have authority. And so really there's a kind of empty place where there needs to be a kind of administrative enthusiasm and encouragement for student-centered education.
Something that needs saying is that the dean of the graduate school is the one who is usually in command of the smallest amount of funds. We feel that that ought to change.
Just because it has affected every other thing in existence, has the current pandemic affected the way we look or strive to get a PhD?
Well, they say that every crisis represents an opportunity. And that's a sad cliche, but there's a way that it might be true here, because the pandemic, we can tell that it's destructive. The full extent of its destructiveness remains to be tabulated because we're still in the middle of it. This is life during wartime, but it's clear it's going to be really bad. And the effects of the pandemic are going to be so serious that they are going to result in certain kinds of retrenchment that we hope will provoke the kinds of changes that are overdue here. It's of course the wrong way to bring about change by leveling the landscape. But if the landscape is going to be leveled, at least we should rebuild in ways that make sense for graduate students and therefore for universities.
You know, what this means is that the crisis we've described, the crisis of unemployment and underemployment for the most learned people in our society, who should be among the most valuable participants in the public good. That crisis is simply going to accelerate as there will be fewer and fewer professorships given the economic situation that's resulting from the pandemic. But as Lenny says, there's a real opportunity here because you can't be ostrich-like. You can't hide any longer from the reality, if you're a faculty member, that your wonderful students who you really care about and who you value highly, as you should, are simply not finding the kind of life that they had expected. So out of necessity may come virtue. I think the pandemic will, in many different ways, create a greater appetite for change, innovation, improvement. Most obviously, in what we're doing right now, this interview is happening via Zoom. There's been a lot of digital instruction going on. That may be an additional possibility once the pandemic is over that helps us bring together small numbers of students into a virtual classroom so that particular subjects that might not have a local audience sufficient to offer a class in could nonetheless be offered. That's just one example of many.
Well, finally, I'm going to give you each a promotion right now. You've been promoted to King of the World to be able to do one thing. If you could change one aspect of the PhD the way it's currently done, you could only do one, which would that be?
We probably will have different answers because I've spent more of my life in administration. There's so many candidates here, Bob. For one thing we didn't talk about is that the typical time to degree, 8 years for a PhD past the BA, 8 years in program. That's ridiculous. That means that you're middle-aged by the time you graduate and then start looking, sometimes fruitlessly, for a job. That's got to change. There has to be a much greater emphasis on teacher training. At present, graduate students tend to teach the courses faculty don't want to teach. Instead, they should have a series of teaching experiences that develop them as educators. And that means not only classroom experiences, but all that it takes to be an educator and working with individual students and so on. Or we could emphasize better advising. We could emphasize career diversity, giving people a sense that their abilities are wonderfully versatile and transferable, that there are many things they can do in life and many choices that they actually have. We could emphasize the fact that we need to educate the people who are going to hire PhDs in corporations, in K-12, in nonprofits, in for-profits, in media, in technology, that PhDs are super employees. But beyond everything, what I would do if I had one change to make would be to empower a dean, a graduate dean, who could provide incentives for making all those other things I mentioned more attractive for the various programs to initiate.
In sum, what we would do if we were king is we would empower the development of an injectable drug that would make people look forward and not back. Forward towards a graduate school that is about students and away from an old tradition that is about replicating faculty, that being a tradition that is worn out. We need to look forward and we need to escape the trappings of an old model that doesn't work anymore.
Robert Weisbuck is a former professor of English at the University of Michigan, president of the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation, and president of Drew University. Leonard Cassuto is a professor of English and American Studies at Fordham University and a columnist for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Their book is called The New PhD, How to Build a Better Graduate Education. Some colleges and universities are dealing with a difficult economy by making a difficult decision, merging with other institutions. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Mergers are a fact of life for some institutions in higher education. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Ricardo Aziz, research professor in the School of Public Health at the University at Albany, says these are not always a bad thing.
Higher education in the U.S. is in crisis, with declining enrollment, negative demographics, excess capacity, and increasing fiscal pressures, all exacerbated by a pandemic of historic proportions. While the top 200 or so universities and colleges seem to be doing well, that is not the case for the majority of the remaining 4,000 or so institutions of higher education in the nation. So it's not surprising that the past 20 years has seen an increasing rate of institutional mergers, not only in the U.S., but also in other parts of the world. Our research on mergers in higher education has led us to several observations. First, mergers in higher education have often been used as a strategy of last resort, which unfortunately means that most of the institutions looking for a merger partner will have exhausted their enrollment, financial, political, and brand equity with poor merger outcomes. In fact, the most common failure in mergers is the failure to consider them at all. Second, mergers should be about student success and opportunity. Well-planned mergers and acquisitions will provide added value to students far beyond any financial savings identified. Third, there are seven key elements that most successful mergers exhibit: a committed and supportive governing board, the right kind of leadership, a compelling and unifying vision, an appropriate sense of urgency, a robust and redundant communication plan, sufficient dedicated resources, and a strong project management system. While having these in place does not guarantee success, not having them does increase the chance of failure. Many colleges and universities will benefit from a more regular and determined consideration of mergers, consolidations, and acquisitions in their annual strategic planning, early and before the institution is in crisis. And the decision to proceed should always be driven by what is best for their students.
And that was Ricardo Aziz of the University at Albany. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOO Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.